Good evening, welcome to Behind the News for June 30, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments lined up for tonight. First, in about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll speak with Diva Pager, who is a sociologist at Princeton University, who's done a study of, or several studies, actually, of how hard it is for ex-convicts to get a job, especially black ex-convicts. We'll get the details on that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with the labor journalist Jonathan Tessini about what's going on with the AFL-CIO, the schism within there, the internal coup or revolution or whatever you want to call it, and the financial troubles at the AFL-CIO as well. So that's in about 30 minutes. And before we get to Diva Pager, first look at the usual news headlines. But even before that, I was very proud to discover today that I made Ken Tomlinson's list of bad people. Ken Tomlinson, the head of Corporation for Public Broadcasting, who hired a consultant to survey the guests on Bill Moyers' show Now, which he was convinced was stacked against the administration. And all the guests for the last couple of years were reviewed and classified. And since I was a guest on Now back in, November 03, I appear on this list, identified as the author of Left Business Journal, actually the editor of Left Business Observer, but accuracy is never very high in the list of right-wing obsessions. And I'm classified as a liberal/Democrat, which is a bit of a surprise to me, and also as someone who opposes the Bush administration, which was no surprise to me. So I'm very tickled, tickled pink, you might say, to be on that list. And you can get it from the NPR website if you want to see what they're up to. National Public Radio got the full notes from Tomlinson's consultant, and they put them up on their website. So you can check that out at npr.org if you're so inclined. Just a couple of hours ago, the Federal Open Market Committee announced its decision to raise the Federal Reserve's to raise interest rates by a quarter point. The federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks lend each other money overnight, the most sensitive indicator of Federal Reserve policy, the target there has been raised another quarter of point to 3.25%. This is the ninth consecutive 25 basis point. A basis point is a hundredth of a point, 100 basis points to a percentage point. This is the ninth consecutive 25 basis point increase since they began tightening policy over a year ago. From the tone of their statement, there's more of this to come. It does seem like the Federal Reserve is committed to slowing down the economy and perhaps righting some of the imbalances that they are very coy about naming, but those imbalances would be our vast foreign debt. More on that in a moment, and also the bubble in the housing market, which continues apace. And I know I promised to look at that, but that's going to have to wait till next week because there's some other things on the plate here to deal with. The International Airport Air Transport Association, which represents 265 airlines around the world, reported yesterday that freight volume in the month of May slowed down. It's been slowing down for the last several months, and that a sign that perhaps the world economy is slowing down and that higher oil prices are actually finally beginning to bite on the real economy. That's one sign of that. Another sign of that, the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index, a survey of people who buy things for corporations around the Chicago area. They publish a monthly survey, which is in a couple of days. It usually comes out a couple of days before the National Purchasing Managers Survey, which is a very timely indicator of what's going on with the manufacturing sector. That number declined, as it has been declining for several months now. It declined in the month of June. Still positive, but much less so than a few months ago. But the employment component of that index now falling below 50, which signifies a contracting employment in the manufacturing sector, at least in the Chicago area. It was as high as 66 just a few months ago in March, now 49. So a rather sharp decline and suggesting a slowdown in manufacturing employment, which is barely been recovering in recent months after a nearly 4-year steady decline in manufacturing employment. So U.S. factory sector still stumbling, it looks. The conference board's tally of help wanted ads in the nation's major newspapers fell in the month of May by 2 points to the lowest level than that it's been at in almost a year. That is not good news. There's some talk that the help wanted measure is not what it used to be because of the growth of internet advertising, but it is heading in the wrong direction. And even if that is a long term trend, what it's saying about the short to medium term is that there seems to be little sign of expansion of new hiring. The weekly tally of jobless claims, that is, people who've just lost their job heading over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that down by 6,000 last week after a 19,000 decline the week before. So that number is looking pretty good, although it's the low end of a range it's been in now for the last year or so. As I've been saying all along, it's a good but not great number. So it does look like the pace of layoffs has slowed, but the pace of hirings hasn't necessarily sped up as much as we'd like to see. The housing sector, though, still very strong. New home sales in the month of May at a 1.3 million annual rate, very close to record levels. I think that the housing market is sort of peaking out, actually. And the Mortgage Bankers Association's measure of mortgage activity declining a bit last week, suggesting that maybe the peak is we're about to hit the peak, or very close to, or maybe even slightly past the peak in the housing market, which has been very, very hot. Let me just leap to this final point because I'm running a little short on time here, and I do want to get to Diva Pager. This morning, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, a statistical agency within the Commerce Department, reported that the international investment position of the United States, that is, our assets abroad held by Americans less the assets held by foreigners in the U.S., that was minus $2.5 trillion, a decline of over $300 billion from the previous year. This figure has been heading pretty much straight down ever since 1980. The fundamental reason for this is that the U.S. keeps consuming more than it produces, resulting in giant trade deficits. The difference between what we consume and what we produce, or what we export and what we import, has to be met by borrowing. And we're doing about $2 billion in borrowing every business day. Although this measure, the international investment position, isn't part of the GDP, it is comparing it to the GDP is a way of measuring the thing over the over the long term, comparing it relative to the size of the economy. Last year's imbalance was about minus 23% of GDP. Figures from a century or so ago are pretty dodgy, but this minus 23% reading is pretty comparable to what we saw when the U.S. was a developing country in the late 19th century. We were borrowing heavily from the then mature and soon to be declining power of the time, Britain, to building up our own industrial infrastructure. Although we are not now, of course, a developing country, we are the top dog, so it's a little unusual to see this. As the U.S. moved to surpass Britain in the early years of the 20th century, our net investment position went positive, first crossing the zero barrier in 1916, continuing to rise to a peak of 30% of GDP and net assets in 1933. Although we came off those peaks as the 1930s progressed, the international accounts remained in the black into the early Reagan years, when the Gipper's tax cuts forced the government to borrow heavily, much of it from abroad, and Americans really developed our skills at living way beyond our means. We broke the zero line going downwards in 1986 and have been plumbing ever deeper depths ever since. This cannot go on forever, as I've said many times, but the how and the when of its coming to an end remains mysterious. Will the U.S. face some sort of catastrophic debt crisis leading to a deep recession, some milder version of that, like a long period of slow growth, high unemployment, and sagging incomes, or will we somehow muddle through? In the classic theories of imperialism, whether Marxist like Lenin's or bourgeois like Hobson's, large foreign assets are a sign of a great power, and large foreign debts of a sign of a weak or a failing country. Right now, it looks like the U.S. is an exception to this rule. Either the rules have changed, or we've got some ugly adjustments ahead. If we were an ordinary country, we'd have the IMF on our doorstep with a structural adjustment program. But we're not an ordinary country. In any case, someone should tell George Bush. Let's take a little musical break and then come back with Diva Pager.
keeps you going? What keeps you going? Great radio, great radio.
And that a bit from Bongwater, album from 1990, whose name I don't think I can say on the air. The voice of Anne Magnuson singing there. And we'll hear a little bit more from Bongwater later in the show. I thought I'd step half a generation back into the hipster music of the time. And now we're joined by Adiva Pager, who's in the sociology department of Princeton University and author of several studies on exploring what happens when people go around, some of them pretending to be ex-cons, some of them pretending not to be ex-cons, some of them black, some of them white, apply for entry-level jobs, and the results of that. Welcome to WBAI, Adiva Pager.
Thanks very much.
So your first study was of applicants in Milwaukee.
That's right.
And actually, before we get to the results of your study, what is the history of this sort of strategy of sending testers around to check on racial discrimination and such?
Well, this is a methodology that was developed by the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, to test for racial discrimination in housing markets. So in the early 1970s, they developed this approach of hiring individuals to pose as interested tenants for various rental units or to purchase property, and sent them to real estate agents and to lenders to see how they would be treated. And this, of course, revealed tremendous evidence of discrimination. And in these early cases, this methodology was used to pursue litigation against discriminating lenders or realtors.
And then, of course, subsequent researchers have applied this technique to testing for job discrimination.
That's right. It's actually not used all that often, but it is a very powerful vehicle to reveal direct discrimination faced by job applicants in especially low-wage labor markets.
And you had some folks go around to employers in Milwaukee. Tell us the story of what that was.
Okay, so in that study, I hired four young men who posed as job applicants, and I assigned them resumes that had equivalent levels of education and work experience, and I trained them to approach employers in similar ways. And I sent them to apply for jobs all over the city, entry-level jobs like restaurant workers, couriers, customer service, retail sales, laborers, et cetera. And had them apply to jobs varying only their race or whether they presented evidence of having a criminal background. So two young men would apply to each employer, one without a criminal background and one indicating that he had recently been released from prison for a felony drug conviction.
And why did you choose that as the crime?
Well, I wanted to focus on a crime that has been, first of all, a major source of the growth in incarceration over the past 20 years and an important source of racial disparities in incarceration as well. And also in thinking about the massive explosion in our criminal justice system, drug crimes are kind of one of the most discretionary offenses. It would be a reasonable strategy to, instead of incarcerating drug offenders, to send them to treatment or to some other sort of intervention. And so I see this is rather than a violent crime or a serious property offense, this is a crime that I think has significant policy implications.
Well, and also an employer might be nervous about hiring someone accused of theft or did time for theft. But
Right. And this is a job, the crime, the type of offense that is of least concern to employers. So it's sort of a conservative test.
And so what did you find?
Well, I found that their employers were very reluctant to hire ex-offenders, so individuals with criminal backgrounds were a half to a third as likely to receive a call back by employers. And actually, blacks were more seriously affected by the stigma of a criminal conviction than were whites. But probably the most surprising finding from the study is that even blacks that had no history with the criminal justice system did only as well, maybe even a little bit worse, than did whites with felony convictions.
That's so shocking. I think you should repeat that.
Yeah, so basically it suggests that being black in America today is like having a felony conviction. A young black man with no contact with the criminal justice system did no better than a white male felon.
And you recount some anecdotes of the white guys who are posing as ex-felons. Some prospective employers actually said, well, I'd like to give you a chance. We all make mistakes in life, right?
Yeah, that came up especially in the New York context. So I recently replicated and expanded this study in New York City, and we found a number of employers who expressed quite a bit of sympathy for the young white ex-offenders. They indicated that they deserved a second chance and that the employer really wanted to help them get back on their feet. And that kind of empathy came up much less often with the black ex-offenders.
And the results you found in New York City with a much, there are many more employers who are sampled, right?
Yeah, it was a much larger study and a much more diverse group of employers. But the results were very similar. That was surprising to me because New York is known as being such a diverse and cosmopolitan city, but we still find very significant discrimination against both ex-offenders and against racial minorities. And in fact, it looked like in these results, again, the stigma of race, the stigma of being an African American, was just as large, if not larger, than the stigma of a criminal conviction.
Yeah, once again, the white guys with the record got callbacks at the same rate as the black guys with no record.
That's right.
Which is really shocking and scandalous. There was a write-up of this study in the Times a week or two ago, and they put that like between dashes. It seemed like it should have been much more emphasized in the story. It's so shocking.
Right.
You've got some statistics in the paper on the Milwaukee study about the number of ex-felons or ex-cons in the United States. It's a stunningly large percentage of the American population, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So there are about 600,000 inmates being released every year. And in the population as a whole, there are about 12 million ex-felons. Most of those are younger individuals, and so that corresponds to roughly 8% of the working-age population.
Yeah, and that was, I think, from 2000, so I imagine the numbers have probably crept up.
That's right. They're steadily increasing.
And, of course, a black man faces something like a 1 in 4 chance of going to prison sometime in his life, right?
It's actually closer to 1 in 3. And for young black high school dropouts, it's closer to 60%. So it's really becoming an increasingly common event in the lives of young disadvantaged men.
I'm speaking with Diva Pager, who is a professor of sociology at Princeton University. And, a lot of when economists study discrimination, they look at things like they try to adjust for all the other things, experience, age, occupational category, whatever, and whatever can't be explained in their statistical models, then they ascribe to discrimination. And this is a very indirect way of approaching this story. But your measure is much, much more dramatic. Is the kinds of blockages that actual people face in real labor markets are quite stunning.
That's right. People are very skeptical of statistical estimates of discrimination because it's so hard to control for all of the characteristics of an individual that might make them more desirable than another individual. But in these experimental contexts, we really can assign people exactly identical qualifications and ensure that they are approaching the employer with exactly the same skills. And so that provides a very, very clear and convincing measure of discrimination.
And, of course, this is also, I think, even in people who are willing to admit that there is significant discrimination in labor markets, they don't necessarily think of the role of being an ex-convict as contributing to the problem, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, a lot of people would respond saying, of course it makes sense that employers are reluctant to hire ex-offenders. It happens to be the case in both of the states that I have done this research, Wisconsin and New York, that there are legal protections for ex-offenders from discrimination by employers. So employers are cautioned that they are only allowed to take into consideration the crime if the specifics of the crime directly relate to the job responsibilities involved. And so this is actually a protected status, and yet the results of this research show that, nevertheless, employers are very reluctant to hire ex-offenders. And when you combine ex-offender status with racial minority status, those effects just grow even larger.
And there are also, in many jurisdictions, whole occupational categories that are off limits to ex-cons, right?
Yes, that's right. So I was only looking at jobs that are legally available to ex-offenders, but states each state decides for themselves which occupations will be limited or restricted to ex-offenders. And those include some jobs that make a lot of sense. So you don't want a violent offender working in a school or in a child care center. But in some cases, these occupational restrictions really seem sort of out of nowhere. So some states prevent ex-offenders from working as an embalmer or as a septic tank cleaner or a real estate agent or a billiard room worker. So there are these strange occupational categories that for particular historical reasons are off limits to ex-offenders.
And also, in a lot of cases, it's a condition of parole that someone actually be out there looking for a job and get employment. That this is kind of a catch-22, isn't it?
Yep, that's right. It's not only a condition of parole, but it's actually the very strongest predictor of desistance from crime. So in looking at for released prisoners, who's going to return to crime and who's going to go straight, the people that have and hold down steady jobs, those are the people that are most likely to be successful. And so really, as a public safety strategy, more generally, it's important for all of us to be thinking about how we can get ex-offenders from prison and directly into jobs, because that's what's going to keep them from going back to crime.
Well, what's your advice? How can we do that?
Well, I think that, first of all, we need better intermediary services. So right now our parole officers are overwhelmed with caseloads and don't have time to provide any individualized attention to offenders. But there are intermediary services like the Center for Employment Opportunities in New York that actually tries to provide links between ex-offenders and employers and to build trust among employers so that they will be more likely to take a chance on a recently released offender. So that's one strategy that I think is important. And I think, you know, this is a controversial position, but I'm not entirely sure that criminal record information should be available forever about every individual. I think when an individual has proven their ability to stay clean and stay out of crime for a sufficient amount of time, they should have the chance of having their record wiped clean so that they're not constantly held back by the stigma of their criminal conviction.
You say some employers ask very specific questions. Have you ever been accused of or ever been convicted of theft? So it's not just general questions about a criminal record, but specific ones. What are the legalities of asking those kinds of questions?
Well, there are very few regulations about asking about a criminal record. So even though in some states employers are not supposed to make blanket restrictions on ex-offenders, they're nevertheless allowed to ask about criminal background information. Some employers choose to be much more restrictive in what sorts of crimes they ask about, as you said. But in most cases, employers just want to know about all crimes or all felonies and then use that information in whatever way they choose.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Diva Pager.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
I've been speaking with Diva Pager, who is a professor of sociology at Princeton University and author of a paper that was published in the American Journal of Sociology a couple of years ago on her study of employers in Milwaukee, and that's actually available on her website if you track her down through Princeton University, Diva Pager, P-A-G-E-R, and also of a draft study of barriers to employment facing young black and white men in New York City with criminal records, not yet published, but also available on her website through Princeton University Sociology Department. And let's take a little break, do a station ID, and I'll be back.
Hi, this is Danny Glover, and you're tuned into WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
We're back here behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood, and got a little couple of minutes left before the half-hour mark. So let me just fill in with a bit more of the economic news, which I didn't get to at the top of the show. The surveys of consumer attitudes, conference boards, consumer confidence index, that popping up in the month of June with people reporting a somewhat better look on the job market. Now the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index at a three-year high. Very, very mixed messages here. Because if you look at some polls, for example, a very large portion of the population saying that the economy is in recession. Something like 44% of respondents to an American Research Group poll of a couple of weeks ago saying the economy is in recession. Now, that seems unlikely in a formal sense, but a lot of people feel that that's the way it looks to them. Yet, on the other hand, the consumer confidence numbers popping up. This is hard to explain. Also, the weekly ABC Washington Post measure popped up very considerably in recent weeks. It's since come off a bit, but recovery from its slide of several weeks ago. And, of course, a week from tomorrow, we'll get the numbers on June employment. And you know, it's really hard to read this right now. This is a very, very strange economy, continues to be. It's not following any of the textbook models, not following any of the roadmaps that I know of, and I've been following business cycles and such since the early 1970s. So it's a very, very strange period. And I think one of the strange things that's going on is that we still haven't gotten through the effects of the bursting of the 90s bubble, and that continues. The effects of that continue to linger on into the present, and the very wacky expansion in the housing market, which I promise I'll talk about in more detail next week, has been giving the expansion more life than it would have had otherwise. But since the federal government's running gigantic deficits, and since until recently the Federal Reserve had kept interest rates very, very low, the amount of stimulus coming from fiscal and monetary policy has been very large, yet this is still the second weakest expansion in the post-World War II period, with the job market especially weak. We're still about 10 million jobs below where we would be in a normal recovery expansion period. So there's many, many cross currents, and it's just very, very hard to read this economy. Some people doing very well, people at the upper end of the income distribution reporting a great deal of confidence and optimism. People in the middle and lower levels, considerably less confidence and optimism, and also very large disapprovals in the polls for George Bush's managing of the economy, his handling of Social Security. It's a very strange period economically and politically. And let's take this little musical break, and then we'll be back with Jonathan Tessini.
I'm traveling in a car with several people. It's a white, late 50s, early 60s style car, and I'm in the back taking it all in leisurely. And we're in California driving around West Hollywood and Beverly Hills, and I've got a flyer that spouts some revolutionary dogma. I'm telling the other passengers that it's time we became leftist radicals again, and I substantiate my theories by pointing out the fact the modern culture that passes outside our window. And C. Carr from the Village Voice is in the backseat with me, and she says, all your work is derogatory. And I'm hurt by this, and I explain to her that I'm not a negative person. It's just that I'm angered by so much of what's around us. And the mood lightens, and we continue our joyride. Everyone laughing as we drive.
And that, an excerpt from Bongwater's, what's the name of the song? Joyride from the album Double Bummer from 1988. Ann Magasin's voice, music of Mark Kramer, David Licht behind her. Much sampled material as well. I don't know how people did all that sampling before there were cheap, fancy computers around, but I guess it's a lot more labor intensive in those days. And speaking of the Village Voice, we're now joined by someone I met through the Village Voice, Jonathan Tessini, who is now a labor journalist and keeper of the Working Life blog, which is workinglife.typepad.com for daily updates on the state of organized labor in the United States and the working life in the United States. Welcome to WBAI, Jonathan.
Glad to be here, Doug. Boy, you're going back in history to the Village Voice.
Yeah, boy, that's like 1990 or something like that.
I think it's before that.
It might even be before that. I brought up the Bongwater from 1988 just because it evoking a long-gone era. And, of course, the Village Voice about to go on strike, it seems.
So I read today in the New York Times. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, actually it was reported in Gawker, the gossip site, just the other day. I'm so distant from the Village Voice now. I don't really know what's going on there. Anyway, the AFL-CIO in turmoil. They've got a convention coming up in a little under a month at the end of July in Chicago.
And, that's correct. Yeah.
Well, what's happening? There are several unions threatening to pull out. There's a Change to Win coalition. Tell us the who's who and what's what here.
Okay. Today I just posted on my blog the set of resolutions that the Change to Win Coalition has put out, which put forth a whole set of structural and organizational changes that they think will revive the labor movement. So let's go back a little bit in time. The first thing that probably is obvious to your listeners is that the labor movement is dying. And if things don't turn around quickly, it'll be gone. The labor movement unions now represent less than 8% of the private sector workforce, which is pretty close to irrelevant, except maybe in a few pockets here and there. About 2 years ago, the Service Employees Union put out a document called Unite to Win, which essentially ignited this whole debate. And to sort of summarize what the SEIU was saying, is they were saying, look, we have to change. We have to have fewer unions. There's too many unions that are trying to compete for the same workers. There's no strategic plan. Too few unions are putting real money into organizing, and if we don't change that habit, we're finished. And in some way, SEIU could have gone off on its own and done its own thing because it's actually been growing pretty dramatically in the last sort of 5 to 10 years.
Now, how much of that is organic growth through organization of new workers, and how much of it is through taking over other small unions and such?
I think it's a little of both, but I think I actually couldn't tell you percentage-wise, but they both affiliated other unions, no question about it, but they've also organized a lot of new workers, janitors, home care workers, a lot of workers in the public sector. Private sector organizing has been difficult for everybody, but I think SEIU has done a slightly better job. Because
they've had some success at organizing janitors, kind of low-wage immigrant labor. And how have they done that? What's their secret?
Well, it's straightforward. They have built pretty powerful community coalitions, I think particularly of the effort they had in Los Angeles, and they put a lot of money behind it and some effort and focus. They did some strategic campaigns which forced some of the owners and contractors to come to the table and bargain. So they've been pretty aggressive about that. And they've also basically made some deals with people who are already organized, said, look, if you don't oppose new places that we organize, we'll guarantee that we'll go out and organize the non-union people so that you're not at a competitive disadvantage. And they've done that also successfully in some places.
So it's kind of a very a large-scale operation rather than the kind of piece-by-piece thing that the labor movement has been trying to do elsewhere.
Yeah, I think they have a big vision of how to do things. You know, they're not perfect, and they've certainly not succeeded in some places, but I think the real issue is that they've really restructured the organization to focus on organizing. And it's not just them. I think that Unite Here has done that. I think CWA has attempted to do some interesting organizing. They're not necessarily in the Coalition to Change. Let's define who the Coalition to Change is. It's the Service Employees Union, the Teamsters, the Laborers, the United Food and Commercial Workers, and Unite Here, which was the merger of the hotel workers and the garment workers.
Now, this is an interesting group because the laborers, at least until a few years ago, had kind of a shady reputation, didn't they?
That's putting it quite mildly.
Yes,
I think that they have, but Terry O'Sullivan, who's the current president, really has come in there and cleaned the place up. I'm not going to sit here and say that every single local throughout the country, the laborers, is completely, you know, Snow White, but I think they've done a dramatic job. And, you know, since we're on that, look, every union, no matter how good they are, is going to have some pockets of, you know, less than savory people. It's, you know, it's a human nature in large organizations. But the laborers have done a very good job, I think, and their president, as I said, Terry O'Sullivan, is into organizing. He's also very much focused on the idea of leveraging the enormous financial resources the labor movement has and trying to affect, you know, use those to affect some of the market power issues.
All right, well, so go on. And so now we have this Change to Win coalition.
So we have this Change to Win coalition, and the fact is that if you step back and look at this over time, they began in something called the New Unity Partnership. That dissolved for reasons that I think are not important to the debate here at this moment, but over time it reconstituted itself as this Change to Win coalition. And at first, there were really two issues here. One is, does John Sweeney have to go? And I assume that everybody, if you listen, knows that John Sweeney is the president of the AFL-CIO. He's been there for 10 years, 71 years old. The question that's been raised by this coalition is this guy the right guy to lead the labor movement? In the last 10 years, has he done what needs to be done? And their answer is no.
Well, I remember when Sweeney first came in, I think it was about when I was first doing this show, there was a tremendous excitement that he was going to revive the labor movement. This was a sign of great things to come. And there was some improvement, but certainly not the kind of renovation and revivification we were hoping for.
He was, in fact, the agent of change in 1995 when he ran. And he was, at the time, the president of the Service Employees Union. He ran as the agent of change to throw out what was then considered the old guard. And I think there's an important thing that we have to keep in mind. You have to look at this in somewhat of a gray tone. And that's no pun intended, since John Sweeney is 71 years old. But on the one hand, who runs the AFL-CIO is important. Because at the very least, it's supposed to be someone who's a symbol of the labor movement. So some people would argue, and perhaps legitimately, that a 71-year-old white Irish guy from New York is not necessarily the best face to put in the labor movement that is trying to recruit young, low-wage immigrants who are not white. At the same time, I think it's important to understand that the AFL-CIO is weak by its very nature. It's a federation. And so the real responsibility of reviving the labor movement really has to come from the affiliated union. So I think sometimes I sometimes fall in that trap myself, invest too much focus on how is the AFL-CIO going to look, what's going to be the structure, who's going to lead it, when in fact it's really about changing these individual unions and kicking their butts out of, you know, the doldrums that really hold the key to the labor movement.
But if we're talking about some kind of grand strategic plan, that does require at least some sort of central structure.
That's correct. Yeah, okay. I agree. And I've argued this a number of times on my blog and other places, that what is lacking and what the Change to Coalition really is pushing hard is that union, every single union, what it does affects the other unions. And it can't be that some union just runs off and does what it wants, and you got 57 different unions with no coordination running off and doing whatever they feel like doing organized. You just can't do that. And there's never been, certainly not in my memory in the last 20 years, a grand strategic plan that everybody buys into, that people agree to do, that talks about organizing strategic targets, and also that people are held accountable to. And what the Change to Win Coalition is doing, in part through their resolutions that they put forth, which, again, you can read. I have it up on my blog today. They're trying to change the structure to enforce some accountability. So it says that every unit's in the AFL-CIO is going to agree to certain standards, and if you want money for organizing, you have to come back and show how it's used, and it's going to have to adhere to a particular plan. Now, what that plan is really unstated, frankly, and I think, again, one of the things I've been hammering on is I don't think either side has answers to some crucial questions.
Well, what are the questions?
Number one, how do you organize on a large scale in an America where there is not, if anybody didn't realize, there's not a big social movement upheaval going on? The labor movement has to organize a net of 1.5 million workers every year to grow just 1%. Last year it only organized, and this is the figures the AFL-CIO uses, 500,000 workers. So the task is huge. You can't organize.
That's not even enough to keep from shrinking, is it?
Huh?
That's not even enough to keep from shrinking, is it?
No, that's why it is shrinking as a percentage of the workforce. So you can't organize 1,000 workers here, 1,000 workers there. So that's crucial. How do you do large-scale organizing? Number two, what do you do about China? If we can't figure out what to do about China and do it in a way that's not that doesn't just ignite a wave of anti-Asian and racist sentiment, you can't solve the issues of the labor movement here in this country, because China, not just at the low end, but within a few years, is going to dominate and be very aggressive about recruiting the high-skilled jobs, too. What do you do about that?
Yeah, they're just developing an auto industry, so...
Pardon me?
They're just developing an auto industry now, so...
Auto industry, they're big, moving into aerospace, all on the high end. You know, it completely obliterates this whole idiotic notion that Robert Reich and others have put forth, the liberals who have said, all you have to do, dumb workers in America, is become more highly trained and educated. And that's just nonsense. Not that education is a bad thing, but it's not going to stop that kind of competition that's based completely on wages.
So, well, it also implies that the Chinese are kind of dumb and can't figure things out themselves.
Exactly.
They're anything but.
It's a completely racist notion in a lot of ways. And this is one of the things, that this notion that this American exceptionalism, that it's the parallel to the patriotism question, right? You have to be strong, and if every speech you have to say, America, you know, we're great, we're blah, 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 democracy around the world. Same thing about workers. We have the smartest workers in the world. Well, that's just not true. So... And number three, and I'll stop there, is what do you do about recruiting young people to the labor movement? Young people have no clue about what the labor movement's about. I did this sort of unscientific focus group with six young people, except for one, I didn't know any of them. And none of them are particularly happy with their jobs, and they think employers are pretty bad to them, but they don't think of unions as the solution at all.
Yeah, I was reading a blog a couple of months ago, some folks in Silicon Valley who were complaining about overwork. And one of them actually said, wow, it's almost enough to make you think about a union. And,
As if that was a novel concept.
Yeah, the tone with which it was suggested was like, you know, it sounds as weird as cross-dressing or something.
And I think it does, you know, there is a question of relevance to people. It gets down to the face of the labor movement. Little things like most members of the executive council, the AFL-CIO, probably still don't know how to use email. They're just not, you know, they don't listen to the same music people under 30 listen to. They're just a complete cultural divide. So how do you make unions attractive to young people in this era where people are all, you know, into their video games and so on? It's a tough challenge.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Tessini, a labor journalist and author of the Working Life blog, which you can access at workinglife, all one word, .typepad.com, or just search for Working Life in Google, and it comes up about the sixth entry, I think. Well, there are also some that the Change to Win crowd is also proposing fewer but better unions, to paraphrase Lenin, the merging of presently fragmented labor movement into fewer but stronger bodies. How does that go down?
Well, it's not going to probably pass in the form that it started out with, which was mandatory merges, which is what SEIU is arguing for. Again, 10 years ago, I wrote this book called The Edifice Complex, which you can actually download for free on my website, which is workinglife.org. It's related to the blog. And I argue the same thing, but frankly, I'm not the first person to argue that. There are many people who have looked around and said, you got all these unions, many of whom have these old names, you know, the plasters and operating, you know, ceramic workers of America, something like that. It's pretty close. They're not relevant to the economy of today in terms of how some of the industries are organized. And more important, they don't have enough resources. You know, some of them have 100,000, 200,000 workers, and they're just sort of limping along. Some of them are just over time dying. The idea is to merge and to create very, very powerful, in theory, unions that kind of cross across an entire industry. So, for example, to have one union that deals with the entire telecommunications industry, to have one union that deals across the board with transportation, to have one union that deals with healthcare. And in theory, it's a theory, you can't prove it. That would result in more effective organizing and more effective bargaining.
Now, the Black Commentator website, which is I hold in pretty high regard, was denouncing this a couple of months ago as a way of eviscerating black leadership in the labor movement. What do you say about that?
Well, I think they made a point. Their view was that by eliminating some unions where not just blacks but Hispanics and probably less Asian, but Hispanics have risen to some power, you were eliminating people from leadership. And the Change to Win Coalition did respond to that, and at least in rhetoric said that's not their intention and that any reorganization of the labor movement, and one of the resolutions, which again you can see in their package, specifically speaks to that and makes, you know, a pretty direct statement. In however we organize labor movement, diversity has to be an underlying, you know, principle to that. So, you know, white, black, or Hispanic, or whatever color, if you did merge unions, some people are going to have to give up some power. And the question is, by giving up power, are you creating a stronger labor movement?
Well, can't they just devise some nice golden handshake packages for some of these aging leaders of smaller unions and get the merger going?
Well, that would be a simple thing, and I think that that's one possibility that's been floated around. The problem is it's not just about money. It's about positioning. You know, there's a certain amount of ego and power that one has in going out and, you know, making speeches, representing people, having a staff. It's a little bit hard to pry that loose from people's fingers. And it's not just true, as you know, in labor unions. It's in any organization.
So the FL-CIO is also having some pretty serious financial problems. They've laid off a bunch of people. What's going on there?
Well, over time, and this was something that I wrote extensively about, and the Federation denied it until I then got a hold of their budget for 2005, which essentially confirmed that they've been running a deficit, and more important, they've been spending down their assets pretty dramatically. Tens of millions of dollars, so that the Federation has far fewer assets than it did when John Sweeney took over it 10 years ago. Now, they would argue that part of that was because they spent a tremendous amount of money on on the elections. And that may be true, and sort of my response was, yes, and your results were pretty poor. So if the argument of spending down the assets, if you should be judged on the financial question by arguing that you did it strategically to do something that would help, you kind of failed at that. But the labor, it is in, the AFL-CIO does have a far more precarious financial situation, which will only get worse. Let me step back to answer your question. And for that reason, they had to lay off 25% of their staff, about 100 or so people. And it'll only get worse if large unions disaffiliate after the July convention, and if they can't pass a permanent increase in the per capita tax, which I think some unions, even though they're supporting Sweeney for reelection, will not go for.
That per capita tax being the amount that each union pays per member into the central pot.
Correct. Every month, per head, whatever an affiliate says, we represent 1 million workers, they pay per head 61 cents per worker per month to the AFL-CIO. And that's basically the money. In addition, that's the major part of the money they get. They also have a big chunk that they get from credit cards they put out.
The AFL-CIO, for an for a body that really doesn't have that many official functions, spends an awful lot of money, doesn't it?
It does, relative to, I suppose, a smaller organization. On the other hand, it's relatively small if you think about all the resources the labor movement has generally, which are in the billions of dollars. The budget's about $120 million, I believe, $110 million. That's not a tremendous amount if you think about trying to run a national organization. But the affiliates argued that it was too big a bureaucracy and that it had to cut down. You know, part of this is an ongoing struggle between centralization, decentralization, between people that want more power in the affiliates and people who think that there has to be a bigger coordinating body at the AFL-CIO. And there's not an easy answer one way or the other for that. One could argue that, in fact, you do need coordination, but I think you certainly can have that coordination without investing a tremendous amount of money in a centralized bureaucracy. The main action and where the work should be is at the affiliate level, you know, the individual unions, partly because it's closer to the rank and file members, and you could have a better feel for what's going on that way.
So let's look ahead to next month's convention in Chicago.
It's time for crystal balling, huh?
Well, let's just first say there's a very unusual voting structure at this convention, isn't there?
Yeah, it is kind of unusual. Let's see if I can say it in the easiest way. The way this works is that affiliates, there's essentially two groups of voters at the convention. There's the affiliates, the unions, that come, and their vote is based on, obviously, how many members they represent, and it's a weighted vote. Then there's this other group of all these central labor bodies and state federations. So all throughout the country you've got, and some of your listeners may have gone to some of these meetings or belong to them, you have got local central labor councils, you've got a state central labor council, sometimes you've got county central labor councils. All of those central labor councils all have one vote. And when you add them all up, these central labor bodies end up actually having more votes than the large affiliates that represent members who are coming to the convention. So to take it, the Change to Win Coalition actually represents about 30 to 35% of the membership of the AFL-CIO, the actual rank and file members. But they will only have actually 9% of the bodies there. So when it comes to certain the way the votes go down, and we can go into that, they're going to have a far smaller voice unless they can get roll call votes that actually where the votes are actually cast based on their per capita and membership. So what
this
that
is not a model of a transparent democratic structure. It doesn't sound
well.
Like.
It's kind of it's transparent in that it's up front. The problem is that it's a throwback to an era that, you know, probably doesn't work, and it gives a whole lot more power. It was a way of investing and encouraging people to work together in central labor bodies. And, you know, where there are good central labor bodies, meaning where there's a body that can help coordinate, you know, at a city or state level, work of all sorts of unions, for example, protests or organizing drives, it's good. But unfortunately, there are too many central labor bodies that should be eliminated. They're just places for hacks and people that have had positions for a long time, and they're just a waste of time, and they waste money and time and resources. But they still have power at these conventions. They have votes.
Well, we've only got a minute left, so now I'm going to make you play that crystal ball game. What's going to happen?
My guess is that if nothing shifts dramatically, though it could, John Sweeney will be reelected as president, that the Service Employees Union will leave the AFL-CIO and perhaps be followed by the Teamsters and Unite here soon after, maybe the food and commercial workers also. So we may see two federations in August.
And will that be a good thing for the labor movement, a bad thing for the labor movement?
I think we're obsessed too much about structure. I think that if there's not so much competition, but if there's a whole new group out there that have new ideas on how to organize and people are working together, not fighting each other, I don't see it as a bad thing.
All right. Well, let's keep an eye out. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan Tazzini.
My pleasure.
And as I said, Jonathan is a labor journalist and the keeper of the Working Life blog, which you can find at workinglife.typepad.com. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week with the promised housing segment, I swear. And let's go out with a little bit more of Bong Water doing a cover of an old Beatles song.